Avoidably detained. We will start today with a, I think we'll do this one. Which one is yours, Sam?
These are mine.
The pink ones are yours?
The pink ones are mine. You can do those last.
Okay.
You can do those and Joe's here first.
Okay. Joe is here, so we will do 881. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 881. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 881 is returning from earlier public hearings, and there is a -3 amendment in your packet which replaces the entirety of the original bill. The bill was introduced by Senator Montes Anderson, and her staff is here to speak to the amendment, as is Brad Swank from the Oregon Judicial Department. What the amendment does, it's consistent with the original intent of the bill, however it is slightly different. Originally, the bill would set up education requirements and a sort of a registry for court-appointed trustees. And what the -3 amendment does is slightly different. It would require a person who is being appointed as a trustee to submit a sort of disclosure statement to the court that includes their contact information, their educational credentials, and the identification of any other trusts that are administered by that person. And it would also require the person to disclose whether or not they have ever been removed by a court as a trustee for cause, or if they've ever resigned as a court-appointed trustee. And if either of those are applicable, they would have to explain the circumstances of the removal or the resignation, including the court number and the address of the court. If a person failed to comply with the disclosure requirement or provided false information in the disclosure, the measure gives the court the authority to remove the person as a trustee and to impose contempt. And the other requirement that the -3 imposes is that if a court does remove a trustee, the court is to notify the state court administrator, and the state court administrator is to maintain a record of removed trustees in a format that would be easily accessible to judges and the public, and that must be maintained for at least 5 years. There are exclusions in the -3, mainly trust companies, institutions that are insured by the FDIC, and any other trusts that are identified by the Chief Justice by rule. Those do not apply. The requirements of this measure do not apply to those entities. And the measure also states intentionally that it does not affect the Chief Justice's ability to require courts to provide information to the state court administrator relating to guardians or conservators or other court-appointed fiduciaries. There's a sunset of January 2, 2010.
Thank you. And, Council, the -3, I presume, replace both the -1 and the -2.
It is an all-inclusive replacement.
Okay. If we could have Mr. Swank and Senator Montes Anderson's representative come up, that would be great. Who said chivalry was dead? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Rossell, and I work for Senator Lori Montes Anderson. Not to recap at all what Joe just thoroughly explained, but this has definitely been a long process with this bill, and I think with the conversations that our office has had with Brad, it's a very good first step in somewhat understanding who is court-appointed to certain trusts. So we are very comfortable with the -3s and think this is a good way to go right now. And with that, if Mr. Swank would like to further...
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'll mention a couple of things about the bill. We worked hard with the Senator's office to try and take out all of the things that would cost money, essentially, to try and figure out a way where we could run a program to provide some protection to people without adding a lot of costs that probably nobody was going to get reimbursed for and tend to make a program inoperable if you don't have the money to operate. I think we found a way to do that. A couple of things I would like to mention. One is we will probably run this program through our UTC, our Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee sort of thing, to set up forms so that people will have a standard form to use in submitting when they're a trustee. We'd like to set up a way to have the judges report in a manner that's not expensive to us, and to put some kind of database on our website is our current thinking about what we're going to do about trustees who have been removed for cause from court-appointed trustees. One of the reasons that you notice in here, and the exceptions, the provisions of this section, which are the filing requirements, do not apply to any other trust identified by rule of the Chief Justice. We may have missed some people who you don't want to include in this reporting requirement, and that gives us the ability to do that. One thing I wanted to mention in the original request, when I was talking to David Hendricks, I suggested that it might be a good idea to make it clearer in law that family members and close friends of trustees could apply to courts if they believed that a trust was being mismanaged, could present evidence to court to make sure that a judge could reach out and look at that trust and make sure it wasn't being mismanaged. David told me that he didn't think it was necessary legally to do that because there was currently no prohibition in that. And when I saw the amendments yesterday morning, I've been trying to contact him since to see if he left that out because it wasn't legally necessary. But at any rate, it's not something to slow the bill down if it becomes. I don't think it's legally necessary either. It was just sort of a roadmap kind of road sign sort of thing that I suggested. If he doesn't feel it's legally necessary, that's fine. But I haven't been able to confirm that with him. If it becomes necessary, we're more than happy to have that put in on the House side so as not to slow the bill down. It's just an indication. Finally, there is a sunset on this that we suggested only because I've run programs in the past that were created by legislation, and sometimes if there's not a sunset, it takes years and years of work to get those taken back out of the statute. But if this program works, it will be one that will be coming in and asking for the sunset to be removed. And another provision, and it's one that Councillor O'Leary mentioned, the provision that says that nothing in this bill affects the ability of the Chief Justice by rule or order to require that courts of this state provide information to the state court administrator related guardians, conservators, and other court-appointed fiduciaries. That language is in there because David Hendricks was concerned that the bill was so limited that it might not be able to apply to conservator situations where it might be appropriate in the future. The relating to clause was not broad enough to expand the bill to relate to conservators and other fiduciaries, but by putting that language in, we make it clear that if this program works and provides appropriate information to judges and to consumers, that somebody can come in and ask for a proposed uniform trial court rule, and the Chief Justice could expand the program to include conservators or other fiduciaries that are court appointed.
So I was wondering about that. So the Chief Justice could do that by rule, could expand the scope?
Yes, Senator Burdick, members of the committee. The Chief Justice, if somebody came in and proposed a rule in the UTCR committee, it would go out for public comment, and it would be expanded to include, if there was evidence that would be a good idea, that could be expanded.
But it can't fit in the relating clause of this bill.
That's correct.
Okay, go figure. All right, thank you. Other questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I apologize. I don't see anything in my notes. I just about what the problem is we're trying to fix. All I've got is the statement from Senator Monis Anderson about what the amendments are going to do, but I don't see anywhere what the problem is we're trying to fix.
And Ms. Rosso, why don't you go over that, because you might have missed the hearing.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, originally how this came about was we had a constituent who contacted Senator Monis Anderson, I believe at church actually, with an issue where one of her constituents had a court-appointed trustee of a fairly large trust fund, and through various circumstances, numerous trustees had been placed on that fund, and it basically sucked the trust dry, and the person whose trust it was not in any capacity to deal with his trust, and so his friend was somewhat looking out for their friend's son who has the trust. And basically what we found out through this whole process is there wasn't any way for judges to realize who they could necessarily be appointing court-appointedly to these trust funds or the trust. And so basically through a conversation we found that we could help judges realize if someone had been removed from a trust and so forth, if there were any red markings, so to speak, on their record.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Krasinski?
Just a clarification, Brad. You said that Section 5, the repeal, the purpose of that is just to make sure it doesn't stay on the books. Unless it's working, then we have to come back affirmatively and take off the sunset.
Chair Burdick, Senator Krasinski, yes, it is a sunset. I mean, technically, if it's working, we might be able to continue. We could probably continue it by uniform trial court rule. It might be good to have it in the statute, but if it's working, we'll be back in to ask that it continue, or somebody else can come back in and see if it's working. We'll ask our judges if it's helping them. We don't even know if there will be a list of court-appointed trustees who have been removed by then, because we don't know how often that happens. It's not something that we track. This will give us information over the next few years about how big a problem this is, and if our judges like it and if it's helping people, we'll be back.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else to add to this? We didn't have anybody else who wanted to participate in this, right? Okay. Senator Whitsitt.
I wanted to get just to talk a little about the continuing education requirements on this. Is this something new? I mean, have court-appointed trustees ever been required to have continuing education before? And if not, what would this continuing education consist of?
Senator Burdick. Chair Burdick, Senator Whitstead, the Dash 3 amendments do not have continuing education requirements for trustees. All they have is a requirement that at the time they're appointed, they file certain information with the court, contact information, their educational background, if they've been removed, that they keep that and information about other trusts that they may be administering, that they keep that accurate within 30 days. So if they've got a change of circumstances, that the judges would know that. But continuing education is gone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Okay, we will, Senator Starr, we are in work session and we have a Dash 3 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 881.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 881. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 881 as amended to the floor with DuPass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 881 as amended to the Senate floor with a DuPass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. We will let Senator Manas Anderson carry this bill if she would like to do that. Thank you. Okay. Now, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 221.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 221 comes to you from the Department of Human Services. The bill makes confidential special morbidity and mortality studies confidential, non-discoverable, and admissible in the proceedings and exempt from the public records laws. Prohibits a person from being examined about this information. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments, which add epidemiologic to the bill, to now its provision. We have Dr. Paul Kaislik from DHS and Alan Tressler, who would like to address the bill and the amendments.
Two of you come on up. Katie, did you want to come up as well? Katie, can you? Okay. We'll just have the two of you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Alan Tressler, representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. You will likely recall the first time we were before you on this bill that we were we want the department to have the ability to collect this information. Secondly, we were working with the department on what we felt needed to be some language changes. Those are minor in nature. We are still working on those, but I would say at this point, given the good faith assurances of the division and the department, that I'm comfortable if you move this bill forward, that we're close enough right now. And Ms. King and I and others will continue to work on this bill in an attempt to improve it, but I have no objection at the moment for you moving this bill forward.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your cooperation. I think this is an important authority to give to them.
I agree.
Appreciate that. Did you two want to add anything to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the Communicable Disease Program for the Department of Human Services. I want to thank you all for your attention to this bill. I don't think that we can conduct our special studies without it. And although we haven't yet reached agreement with all the parties, I'm grateful for their willingness to work with us on it.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Senator Starr?
Are we moving the Dash One Amendment?
Madam Chair.
That is the recommendation.
Senator Starr, yes, we would support the Dash One Amendments.
Thank you.
He has to get his motions prepared here. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
You bet.
Senator Starr?
Yes, I move the Dash One Amendment, Senate Bill 221.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 221. Any discussion? Senator Pazanski?
Madam Chair, I'm supporting the Dash Ones. I also want to just put on the record that I really think that this agency needs to have more authority than it actually has in the sense of a police power. I mean, right now, from my discussions with them, they're not able to require someone to actually provide them with the information. If we have an epidemic or something that needs to be addressed, based on what I've heard, they don't have any way to actually force anyone to give them the information that could be very vital to many people in the state if we had some type of terrorist type of issue that occurred. It's not something that they're looking for, but I just think we need to put it on the record that I hope that we will be looking at this in the future, because if we ever find ourselves in such a situation, I don't want to have to see this agency have to try to get something through the court where they may not have the authority to get.
I appreciate those comments, and I assume the appropriate parties were listening. Thank you. Any other discussion? Senator Walker, we're voting on the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 221, which is providing the Department of Human Services with ability to make information confidential and non-discoverable for epidemiological studies.
I thought we had a problem with this bill. Does this resolve everybody's concern?
It's far enough along that the trial lawyers are comfortable moving it today.
Between Monday and today, they've figured it out?
They're very reasonable people.
And let's see, I met with them on the 29th and then the trial lawyers on the 2nd, and they all resolved it? Oh, then I'm okay.
So that may be a slight overstatement.
Work in progress.
Work in progress.
If it's a work in progress, it's going to get us moving.
With good faith on all sides, from what we hear. So we are now finding out if anybody has objection to the Dash One Amendments. No objection. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 221 to the floor, but as amended, the do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved the Senate Bill 221 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Okay. Next we have, do we have a split for that? Council Taylor, we have, I've actually asked for a script for the Senate Bill 568, as I understand. Do we have to suspend the rules to...
Yeah, sure, I believe that's correct. The motion, unanimous consent to suspend the rules and the motion to reconsider the...
Okay. I ask unanimous consent to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering Senate Bill 568. Any objection? So ordered. And then we need a motion, right? Senator Starr, would you like to move for reconsideration of Senate Bill 568?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 568.
Senator Starr has moved that we reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 568. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I think it's back on the table. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 568.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 568 comes to you from Senator Pozanski and allows the court to suspend a person's driver's privileges for up to 30 days if a person exceeds the speed limit by more than 30 miles an hour. If the person drives 100 miles per hour or greater, requires the court to impose a fine of $1,000 and suspend the person's license for not less than 30 days, no more than 90 days. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the Dash 1 amendments, which go to page 1 of the bill, at line 27. Before the period in insert, and the person has received at least one prior conviction under ORS 811-100 or ORS 811-111 within 12 months of the date of the current offense.
Okay. Senator Pozanski, did you have anything to add on this?
Madam Chair, the reason we are ringing the Dash 1s is after we had passed this bill, I gave thought to what some of the conversation was at the table and realized that it would be, I think, a much better bill with greater support if we actually put some sideboards or parameters. And speaking with some of the members on the committee that had some reservation, even though they may have favored the bill, they thought that this would address those concerns, and I actually feel more comfortable because, as one person said to me after the hearing that was from the public, there was a concern that this may be misused, and so this will actually put a requirement that you have at least one prior speeding conviction within the 12 months prior to the new date of the offense. And so, and then it still keeps it before it can be suspended under the discretionary, a requirement that they are convicted of exceeding the speed limit of over 30 miles an hour.
Okay.
I have a question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Without getting up and pulling the statute, what does 811-100 and 811-111 say about the conviction? Is it any speeding violation?
It talks about the two areas that we have enforcement statutes. One is for the basic rule, the other is exceeding the max. Those are the two statutes that set forth when someone's in violation. And so it's applying it to the areas where enforcement could be taken.
So let me pose a scenario, if I could, Madam Chair. If you're driving 30 miles an hour in a 20-mile-an-hour zone and you get a ticket, and then within the next 12 months you're caught going 30 miles an hour over the speed limit, then this bill would kick in?
If I heard your example, if you have a speeding ticket that has reached a where you've been convicted of it, and within 12 months of the date of conviction, you have a subsequent speeding mm-hmm. ticket that is greater than 30 miles per hour, the court would have the discretion to apply the suspension if it deemed it appropriate.
And it's not automatic.
Not on that one. It would be automatic on the other one where you get triple digits.
Okay. I get it. So it would be automatic if you hit triple digits, the suspension would be automatic, and the amendment doesn't apply at all to the enhanced fines. Is that correct?
It does not apply to anything on the what would be under sub 5, line 28. It only applies to the going over 30 miles per hour.
But it also only applies to the license suspension aspect of that.
That's correct.
Yeah, it doesn't apply to the fine.
That's correct.
Okay. Everybody understand the Dash 1 amendment?
I understand the amendment, Madam Chair, but I think you took this up when I had to leave because I had another hearing I had to go chair, but I see that the issues discussed included that police usually do not issue a ticket when a motorist is a true emergency, so you're rushing to the hospital and you get stopped and you don't get
we had quite a conversation.
Yeah, you missed that conversation. There's a defense called choice of evils defense.
Okay.
And that is what someone would be relying on if they actually went to court, but as the state trooper who testified, Dan Swift, testified, normally you would not see this, and then we actually had a personal story shared with us from the dais.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, then my questions are answered. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Starr, we have the Dash 1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 568.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 568. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 568 as amended to the floor for the due-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 568 as amended to the Senate floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Pruzanski, would you like to try again?
It would be my pleasure.
Okay. All right. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2287. Council.
Chair Brady, the committee. House Bill 2287 comes to you from the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. It's basically a housekeeping bill related to bankruptcy proceedings. It has several provisions. Most notably, it allows a debtor, a trustee in bankruptcy, or the attorney representing either of those to file a notice of bankruptcy to give constructive notice as opposed to a certified debtor's petition. The reason for this is filing one of those notice of bankruptcy would be more efficient. It contains more information and involves less time delays. The other provisions of these bills provide they delete obsolete references to the National Bankruptcy Act. It also provides that certain judgments and orders of the bankruptcy court must be certified by the bankruptcy court clerk rather than the district court clerk.
Okay, and you must be Mr. Blackledge.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Gary Blackledge, for the record. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section. As committee counsel has mentioned, the current law provides only for the recording of a petition of bankruptcy to give notice in distant counties of a bankruptcy that may affect real property. The petition has the debtor's name, the case number, and maybe the debtor's attorney, but it does not, particularly in a Chapter 7 proceeding, give the name of the trustee or the trustee's counsel. In a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, upon the filing of the petition, that property becomes the property of the bankruptcy estate under the administration of the trustee, and that trustee is the real party in interest. And so the purpose of this bill is to be able to give prospective purchasers and encumbrancers notice of this bankruptcy filing, and also to enable the trustee to easily record the notice of bankruptcy, much in the same way as a notice of pendency of action is recorded in a state court matter, because sometimes it's difficult for the trustee to go and get the certified copy from the court of the petition. There's a delay. It doesn't provide all the information that a prospective purchaser may want to see. The other aspects of this bill is it does correct 93-770 of the Oregon Revised Statutes that it did does contain some obsolete references. The debtor-creditor section urges the committee to move this to floor with a due-pass recommendation, and I want to beg the committee's indulgence. There is, in my written testimony, an error in the second to the last sentence that was missed when this testimony was revised. It does refer to the House rather than the Senate, and so I apologize for that. Thank you. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Oh, we can pass it if it refers to the House. No.
That's right. I really loved this bill until I heard that.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I know he probably didn't change his testimony very much, so we don't have original testimony.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Is this notice a one-page notice?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I anticipate that it would be a one-page notice. In the early 90s, I used to get away with recording these notices of bankruptcy, but the county clerks have cracked down on what can be recorded, and typically it included just the information that we have here and a notarization acknowledgement or a subscription signed by the attorney for the trustee.
And Chapter 7 petition is 20 or 30 pages, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
The current statute just says the filing page, which will be the first page.
Right, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. We will close. Did you have anything else to add?
No.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2287 and open a work session on House Bill 2287. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2287 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2287 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Okay, we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2288.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2288 also comes to you from the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill allows the primary lien holder to satisfy subordinate liens or security interests with excess proceeds from the sale of personal property in a possessory lien foreclosure. And right now, there are no provisions under Oregon law that allow a subordinate lien holder to obtain the excess liens from such a foreclosure sale. Those proceeds, excess proceeds, are now put in the court where they're held for the lien debtor to claim. It's my understanding this bill puts Oregon law into conformity with the Uniform Commercial Code for this section. It passed out of the House with a unanimous vote.
Thank you, and you must be Mr. Hersher.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is David Hersher. I'm in private practice of law in Portland. I've been practicing since 1981, and I'm here on behalf of the same committee that Mr. Blackledge is the chairperson of. The current statute, we presume, was not drafted in contemplation of the possibility of there being two or more liens on property that would be subject to a lien and sold. And therefore it doesn't contemplate the problem of surplus proceeds being generated upon a sale by the senior lien holder, which in equity should go to the second lien holder rather than the lien debtor. And that's the simple problem that it fixes. And I want to apologize for making the same mistake Mr. Blackledge did on his testimony. I apologize for that.
You're going to give us quite a complex here if this keeps up. So. Are there questions from the... And this has no amendments that I see. Is that
That's correct?
Correct. Are there questions from the committee?
No, Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Hersher. I've seen you in bankruptcy court. And you're a good speaker. You enunciate well. Let me ask you this question. So any excess proceeds are paid to the county treasurer currently, and this bill wants to make it so it goes to the junior lien holders?
That's correct.
Okay. That seems really unfair that it's been going to the county treasurer anyway.
That's correct.
So I think that's really a good thing. All right. I'm just clarifying that. Wow. County treasurer, I'm surprised county treasurer hasn't objected because they can lose quite a bit of money, but... Madam Chair, I think it's a great bill. Yeah, and they don't need to come either. Junior lien holders deserve it.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 2288 and open a work session on Senate Bill House Bill 2288.
So now Madam Chair, move House Bill 2288 to the floor with the two pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2288 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this bill that you like so much?
Yes, Madam Chair. My judges would be proud.
Okay. Thank you. Okie dokie. Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2289. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2289A is also brought to you from the Elder Section, or I should say is brought to you from the Elder Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill removes a four-month time limit that a claiming successor or personal representative has to file supplemental affidavits to amend the original affidavit for estate property that is found after the original filing. You have before you -A2 amendments. Those amendments provide that only affidavits filed for the purpose of including property not described in the original affidavit are subject to the four-month time limitation. Those amendments are consistent with the intent of the bill, and that is to allow supplemental affidavits to be filed for small estate proceedings when property is found subsequent to this four-month time limitation running. The problem that individuals encounter when they find property, it's usually not worth it to set up a new probate or do a new probate because the property usually isn't worth the cost of doing so. So that property is usually abandoned. This bill will allow individuals to file a supplemental affidavit at any time after the original affidavit is found for such property.
Okay, and we have signed up for this Ryan Gibb. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Ryan Gibb. I'm the chair of the legislative subcommittee of the Elder Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. Who had originally requested House Bill 2289. Currently, there are. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. Currently, the statutes relating to a small estate allow for property in the amount of $50,000 for personal property and $90,000 for real property to be passed through a small estate procedure, which is less expensive and less time consuming than a full probate. The purpose for that is to allow these small estates to be passed to the devisees or the heirs of the decedent without creating a cumbersome and time consuming process, which may in fact consume all the assets to be passed. The small estate procedure allows an affidavit to be filed with the court, and within 4 months, a supplemental affidavit may be filed as the law currently stands if there's an amendment that needs to be made to the original affidavit. The bill before you, House Bill 2289, would allow for supplemental affidavits to be filed beyond that four-month period for the purpose of including after-found or later-found assets as long as the aggregate of the estate is still within the original small estate value limits. There's a concern that was raised that perhaps allowing supplemental affidavits to be filed and allowing claims to be filed against that property would cause a problem, especially for title companies. If real property is passed, that if a supplemental affidavit was filed, a claimant would try and file a claim against the original property from the original affidavit. The Elder Law Section requested the -A2 amendment to clarify that subsequent claims are to be paid from the subsequently found or later found assets and not from the original assets which were passed to the original small estate affidavit. And I would urge the Judiciary Committee to pass this to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. I would like the committee to notice that the Elder Law Section recognizes this is a Senate committee and not a House committee. Thank you very much.
There's somebody on the bar support staff who needs a new program. Okay, so what you're saying is the -2 amendments don't change the intent of the bill, but they merely clarify. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair. Okay. Members of the committee.
Okay. Is there any questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. So what currently happens right now if right after the initial affidavit is filed, 5 months pass, and then additional property is found, what happens?
Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, the property is either abandoned or a full probate would have to be filed. The statute does not allow for the filing of a supplemental affidavit after that four-month period. You may have a trial court clerk which allows it, but the statute doesn't specifically allow for that. And so there is a bit of a divergence between trial courts in different counties as to whether or not that will be allowed.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Please.
I mean, it seems to me that the purpose of that, well, 4-month deadline was to make people clean up the estate and move to finality. And I guess I am wondering whether just by removing that you're going to leave things open-ended. That's the concern.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, the elder law section understands that concern, and the purpose is not to grant an unlimited amount of time in which to file the affidavit, but it's to allow for after found property located or discovered after that 4-month period to be probated without requiring a full estate. Perhaps there's a box of $25 savings bonds that's identified, or a small bank account located somewhere. And if the 4-month period has expired, the heirs or the devisees of the estate either have to decide whether to abandon that or to proceed with a full probate. If the value is $1,000 or $2,000, it's not worth it to reopen or to open a full probate for that, and so you're essentially requiring that they just abandon the property.
Yeah, Madam Chair? It just seems like another way to go at it, though, would be to allow for the estate to be reopened in the event of additional found property.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, the estate and the small estate proceeding is never technically open. Once the small estate affidavit is filed, the court computer system notates that the case is closed. So there isn't essentially an open or closed case. There is simply the filing, and that filing then is sent out according to statutory notice rules. At that point, once that is sent out, creditors have 4 months to file their claim, the technical term in the statute is to present their claim against that state property.
I was curious, what if they find property that puts it over the threshold of a small estate?
Madam Chair, as the current statutes would allow, there would need to be a full probate established. And there is actually a House Bill 2547, which has passed through the House, and I believe is on its way over here, which increases the value limits on the small estate to $50,000 for personal property and $150,000 for real property. So there will be some more estates which will fall within the small estate limits, but should either the personal property or the real property values push that up over the small estate limits, it will automatically require a full probate to be established.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Gibb. How can the personal representative be dismissed by the court if the estate can be added to in perpetuity? I mean, how can the personal representative ever really finish their job?
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the affiant, the person filing the affidavit, isn't technically considered a personal representative, and so they aren't. They are not given the statutory powers of a personal representative, ORS 114, 500 and the following statutes provide certain powers for the individual filing the affidavit, what they technically call the affidavit of claiming successor, and they're given specific powers and specific authorities, and then the statute actually provides that 4 months after the filing date of that affidavit, the property listed in that affidavit vests in the devisees or the heirs that are listed in the affidavit. And so technically at the 4-month point, that property passes by operation of law to those individuals who are listed within the small estate affidavit. Therefore, there's no granting of personal representative powers. There are some specific powers which are conferred upon the claiming successor, the individual filing the affidavit, which terminate at a designated point in time by statute.
Thank you.
Four? Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We will close the... So we have the dash 2 amendment on this. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2289 and open a work session on House Bill 2289.
Madam Chair, I move the -82 amendments to House Bill 2289.
Senator Starr has moved the -82 amendment to House Bill 2289. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
House Bill 2289 has amended the floor. The due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2289 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we will have Senator Ringo carry that bill. Okie dokie. Now we will move to a public hearing on House Bill 2290. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2290 comes to you from the Elder Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill extends the time for filing accountings by personal representatives and conservators from 30 to 60 days. Right now, it is difficult for personal representatives and conservators to meet that 30-day time limit due to some of the records they must compile to file these accountings. Specifically, bank records were mentioned. That means that they have to extend this filing time, which takes their time, the court's time, and to do so. You have before you Dash 1 amendments. The purpose of those amendments are to restore the 30-day time limit for personal representatives and conservators in specific situations, specifically when they've either been removed, when they've resigned, for the resignation of the revocation of the personal representative's letters, or the termination of the conservator's authorities. Again, in those situations, the time limit would be 30 days and not the extended 60-day time limit.
Thank you, Mr. Gibb. You're back on again on 290 and the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Ryan Gibb. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, the chair of the Elder Law Section Legislative Subcommittee of the Oregon State Bar. I'm here in favor of House Bill 2290, proposed by the Elder Law Section. My practice includes a number of what are termed protective proceedings, guardianships, conservatorships, and estates also. In conservatorships and in estates, the fiduciary appointed by the court has to file an annual accounting and then at the end of their term has to file a final accounting. The Uniform Trial Court rules require specific documentation, including bank statements, through the end of the accounting period. The statutes currently allow 30 days between the end of the accounting period, the end of the anniversary of the appointment or the termination, the closure of the estate, and the requirement of filing that accounting. So there's a 30-day period to compile the information and get it filed. There are a number of cases and reasons why the it's difficult to meet that 30-day limit. It takes time to get bank statements in. It takes time to get all the documentation in the proper form for the court. Courts routinely will grant a 30-day extension to that requirement to file an accounting, and generally will do so without too much discussion. However, the courts may hesitate at that, and in cases of professional fiduciaries who may have a couple dozen of these protective proceedings or estates open, they may be routinely requesting these, which may look a little bit strange to the court. The Elder Law Section has requested that the time period in which to file an accounting be extended to 60 days to allow an extra period of time in which the fiduciary should be able to gather all that documentation and get it filed with the court. My understanding from talking with at least one probate judge, Rita Batts Cobb from Washington County, is that her practice of allowing the extension would stop without some really good reason should this be extended to 60 days. So we would be looking at a 60-day time period in at least some counties where there wouldn't be an extension granted without a very good explanation for why that was needed. So we'd be creating a longer period of time in which to file the accounting and less reasons to request these extensions. So you'd be cutting down on the need for the court to review and grant or deny extensions to that time period, and hopefully getting those accountings filed within that 60-day period. There was concern raised with regards to allowing the extra 30 days in cases where the fiduciary has been removed or will be resigning or is resigning. That concern was dealt with in the Dash 1 amendment, which has been provided and which was drafted at the request of the Elder Law Section. That would exclude those cases where the fiduciary is being removed or is resigning from the additional 30-day period. So in general cases where we have an annual accounting or a final accounting, the period to file the annual account or the final account will be 60 days. If there is a concern about the fiduciary or if that fiduciary is resigning, then that time period is still just the 30 days.
Okay, but the court would still have discretion to extend that if they needed to.
The court still has the discretion to extend it. It's just that my understanding is courts probably wouldn't be quite so generous in just automatically granting those.
Appropriately so,
I'm sure. Right. Well, and if I may, as Madam Chair, as Judge Cobb from Washington County said, fiduciaries are granted a little bit longer rope which with to hang themselves. So they have a little more time in which to get these filed, and they'd better get them filed on time.
We like judiciary humor here. So are there questions for the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2290 and open a work session on House Bill 2290. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2290.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2290. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2290 as amended to the floor at the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2290 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Great.
I would like to make your day, Senator Beyer. Okay, last bill. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2291.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2291 also comes to you from the Elder Section of the Oregon State Bar. This bill adds trustees to the list of those who have standing to bring a cause of action for financial or physical abuse of an elderly or incapacitated person. Currently, there are four classes of persons who can bring such a cause of action. An elderly person who is described as a person over 65 years of age, an incapacitated person, the guardian or conservator of either of those two, or the personal representative of the estate of a decedent who is incapacitated or over 65 years of age. Again, this bill adds trustees to that list of individuals who can bring such cause of action.
Okay. Mr. Gibb is back on deck here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, again, Ryan Gibb here on behalf of the Elder Law Section Legislative Subcommittee, the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2291 has been proposed for the purpose of adding, as has been stated, trustees to the list of those who may bring an action for elder abuse. List currently is limited to a certain group of people who should be endowed with that power. However, trustees of a trust oftentimes have the very intimate knowledge of the creator or the settlor of the trust and what's happening with them. And this bill would allow that trustee to have the authority to bring an elder law action on behalf of the elderly individual, which they do not currently have standing to bring.
Okay, thank you. Is there any discussion? Any questions? Not discussion, questions. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2291. Open a work session on House Bill 2291. We have no amendments.
Chair, move House Bill 2291 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2291 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay, that completes our agenda. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Excellent.
Hey, Roger.
Duff.